Bueno, mientras me dirijo a ustedes, tenemos dos grandísimos personajes sentados acá. Jack ganó el premio Nobel el 2009 con descubrimientos que se hicieron 27 años antes. Matt está hoy trabajando en temas que probablemente van a ser el premio Nobel de 20 años más. Ahora les van a contar. Jack, además, está trabajando en temas que probablemente también postulen al mismo premio Nobel, así que van a estar compitiendo. Están escuchando o van a escuchar a dos personas que están liderando el conocimiento en biología hoy en el mundo, y es un tremendo privilegio. Lo que ellos están haciendo está en la frontera, es difícil de entender para cualquiera que no esté en el área de la biología, pero... ellos han hecho varias charlas de divulgación y estoy seguro que no importa que uno no entienda todo, vale la pena, por último, sentir la visión y la energía que ellos tienen. Jack nos va a contar, va a hacer una presentación primero de lo que él está haciendo y después vamos a conversar con él y vamos a hacer algunas preguntas. Gracias, Jack. Ah, perdón, Jack es químico. Tenía que presentarlo. Es químico, es profesor de la Universidad de Harvard, también trabaja en el Massachusetts Hospital, ¿no? Yeah. Tiene un premio que se da en Estados Unidos a científicos muy destacados, que es el Howard Hughes Medical Award. Es destacadísimo por todos lados donde se mire. Partió por química y terminó en la biología y hoy está en la interfase. Esa es la historia que nos va a contar. Puedes contarnos.
Okay. Okay. I'm going to go to the podium. Okay. Thank you very much for the invitation to be here and to tell you about some of the work that we've been, some of the questions we've been exploring over the last 10 or 15 years. So this question of how life began is, I think, something people have wondered about for thousands of years. It's been a very difficult question to approach scientifically until recently. But over the last decade or so, the pace of discovery has really increased dramatically. There are more and more laboratories making progress, and I think that we have a good chance of really understanding how life got started on our planet in the near future. Now, of course, I didn't always work on this question, so I thought I would just say what sort of brought me into thinking about this interesting issue. And what actually happened is after I did the work that led to the Nobel Prize, I wanted to go and do something different. And I started working with evolution, using the principles of evolution, but not to evolve organisms, plants or animals or even bacteria to do useful things, but to evolve molecules, to do things that we wanted. And that's actually not that hard in the laboratory. You can basically... start with large numbers of different molecules and find the ones that, just by chance, because of their sequence, do something interesting or useful. But after working on that for a decade or so, I started to wonder how evolution got started on our planet all by itself. It's one thing to use evolution as a tool in the laboratory when you have all the latest equipment and enzymes and brilliant students to do the experiments. But on the early Earth, there was nobody there. How did evolution get started? Okay. So in addition to that, there is also a very interesting convergence between astronomy and chemistry and biology. Because from the work of many astronomers, we know that our galaxy has probably millions of planets similar to the Earth, orbiting stars similar to the Sun. So we know for sure there are many, many places out there that could support life. But what we don't know is whether any of them actually do. Okay, and we all want to know, are we alone in the universe or is the universe filled with life? Okay, so the astronomers are working really hard to detect signs of life on planets around other stars. But we don't, the answer, you know, whether there's life out there or not depends on whether it's easy or hard for life to get started on a young planet. And that, I think, is something we can address by doing very simple experiments in the laboratory and trying to see if there's actually a pathway from chemistry to biology where we can actually show and understand all of the steps. And if all of those steps look easy and look like something that could happen spontaneously on a young planet, we would conclude that, yes, it's likely that the galaxy, the universe, is filled with life. On the other hand, if we can show that there are some steps that may be incredibly difficult, then life could be very rare, right? It's still possible that, in fact, life only exists here. So in order to get some insight into that question, we have been going into the lab. But actually, before I get into that, let me just show you. This is an illustration, an animation, that illustrates one of these other solar systems, right? From the Kepler Space Telescope, we now have evidence, direct evidence, for thousands of other solar systems. And this particular solar system is interesting because it has three inner planets that are very hot, much too hot for life. But they have two outer planets, similar in size to the Earth, that are within this this green zone where the temperature is just right. You could have liquid water, and the possibility for life exists there. Okay. So coming back to this question of, well, you know, we want to know, could there be life there? And at the same time, how did life get started here? Okay. So why has it been so hard to answer this question, right? What's really been the difficulty that has slowed progress? And the answer is, in my opinion at least, that it's really because of just a way of looking at the problem and the kinds of biases we have in our thinking that come from working on modern biology, which is incredibly complicated. Right? All modern cells are very complex structures. They have beautiful structures like you can see here, with complicated filaments and DNA in blue. But in order to make these structures, underneath this, there's very complicated biochemistry. There are thousands of chemical reactions going on in our cells and in every bacterial cell all the time. These chemical reactions are controlled by enzymes, which are themselves complicated protein structures. But this is not even the most difficult aspect of modern life. Underlying and controlling all of this machinery is the flow of information from DNA, where our information is stored, to RNA, and then expressed in proteins, which catalyze our metabolic reactions and control signaling within and between cells, and those protein enzymes create the structures and the biochemistry that we see in all of modern life. Okay. And all of this, there's so much complexity, it was very hard for decades or centuries to think in a rational way about how life could have started spontaneously on a young planet. And in particular, in this flow of information, there's a special problem in that everything depends on everything else, right? You can't replicate, you can't copy DNA without the help of RNA, without the help of protein enzymes, and without the biochemistry that comes from the activity of those enzymes. But at the same time, you can't make RNA without DNA and protein enzymes. You can't make proteins without DNA and RNA and the biochemicals and so on. So everything depends on everything else, and nobody could come up with a rational explanation for how this would be possible. made life seem like a miracle, except to a couple of smart people who pointed out in the late 1960s that RNA in the middle has a central role, and maybe there was something special there about how RNA could have been responsible for the beginning of life. And they thought, well, RNA, we know it codes for information. We knew in the 1960s that RNA could make complicated shapes. And they thought maybe RNA could act like an enzyme. Nobody paid any attention to this wild theory until almost 20 years later, when Tom Cech discovered experimentally that RNA can act like an enzyme. It can catalyze chemical reactions just like proteins. And all of a sudden, the problem became much simpler. Okay, we no longer had to figure out how this interdependent system could, all the parts could arise simultaneously. Now we can focus on RNA in the context of a cell. So now what we need to understand to solve this problem is, how do we take the chemistry of a young planet and get to cell-like structures that contain RNA molecules, RNA that can encode information in its sequence and that can catalyze biochemical reactions. So a simplified version, a greatly simplified version of modern cell structure. Okay, so in my way of thinking about this, we have three big questions. We want to understand the chemistry that gave rise to the building blocks of biology, the lipids, the amino acids, the nucleotides. We want to understand, once we have these molecules, how do they spontaneously, all by themselves, come together to make structures that look and act like cells that can grow and divide. Okay? And finally, we'd like to understand, what are the special environments on the early Earth that could allow all of these processes to happen, could nurture and support the growth of very primitive cells. So, one of the most fascinating and really ironic aspects of the chemistry is that cyanide, not something that you would think about as being good for life, but cyanide is really, we think, now the source of life. It's the source of all of the building blocks of biology. So, there are two aspects to that. One is that it turns out cyanide is very easy to make in the atmosphere of a young planet where there's no oxygen. We think the atmosphere of the early Earth was mostly nitrogen, some carbon dioxide, traces of hydrogen, methane, other gases. And when that kind of atmosphere is hit by ultraviolet radiation, by lightning, by the impacts of meteorites, these simple molecules are ripped apart to atoms. The atoms come back together, and sometimes they come back together in the form of cyanide. Okay. Now, if that cyanide just rained into the ocean, it would be no good at all. It would be diluted, it would hydrolyze, nothing good would come out of it. But my colleague John Sutherland in the United Kingdom has come up with a very interesting speculative theory about how cyanide molecules could be captured and built up over long periods of time to make a reservoir, a geological reservoir of cyanide. And the idea is quite simple. In an environment where you have geothermal circulation, so you have magma underlying the rocks, so providing a source of heat, you have water in a lake, there's circulation of the water. It brings ions up. They're leached out of the minerals, come into the water, react with the cyanide. They precipitate out. They build up layers of different salts. And you could imagine over thousands or even millions of years storing a huge reservoir of cyanide in this form. And then when that cyanide is processed, if the heat increases, the water dries out, water comes back in, amazing chemistry happens. Cyanide stores a lot of energy and undergoes very interesting chemical pathways, some of which are driven, again, by ultraviolet light. And these pathways, which are being worked out as we speak, lead to all the building blocks of biology, the lipids, the nucleotides, amino acids. These can make peptides. Lipids can make vesicles. You have everything you need coming from cyanide. Okay. So the part of the problem of the origin of life that we specialize in my own laboratory, is once we have all these molecules, how do you get cells? And so the way we think of it is by having a model of what a very, very simple cell could look like. Essentially, a simple cell membrane enclosing some short fragments of RNA. Okay? So it turns out the molecules that make membranes, right, can form spontaneously. The molecules that can make RNA can form spontaneously. Building these structures is actually quite easy. The part that is the most interesting and complicated is, how do they grow? How do these cells grow? There's no evolved machinery. There's no biological machinery because evolution hadn't started yet. How do they grow? And then, once they've grown, how do they divide? Right? And how do these RNA molecules get copied so that the next generation of daughter cells can inherit that information? Okay, so let me tell you just a little bit about the membrane aspect. So the molecules we use are very simple, as shown here on this side of the slide. They're basically soap. These are simple soap-like molecules. You shake them up in water with a little salt, not too acidic, not too basic. They spontaneously assemble into these incredibly beautiful structures that you can see over there. They're very much like cell membranes, and so you have outer layers and you see smaller vesicles on the inside. Now, the question, of course, the important question is, how do these things grow and divide spontaneously? We have to rely on the environment to drive growth. And so for many years, we studied this process in very indirect ways. We always wanted to see it. We just wanted to make these vesicles and watch them grow. So I'm going to try to show you a movie taken through a microscope. So this is a microscopic a video. It's a real experiment. What you see here, this little circle, is one of these little soap vesicles. And we're going to add more molecules so it can grow and just watch what happens. Now, we kind of expected it to just get a little bigger or become a little bit elongated. When my student came to me and showed me the actual way that it grew, I almost fell off my chair. I was so surprised. And so I want to show you that process. What happens is, you see this narrow filament starts emerging out of the original vesicle. Over about half an hour, it grows longer, makes branches, all the material in the initial vesicle gets distributed. Nothing has leaked out. All the contents are still inside, but it's grown into this very dynamic filament. So this is just soap and water, nothing fancy. This experiment could have been done 50 years ago, but nobody really appreciated the physical chemistry that could lead to this kind of process. So that is how we think these things grow. And the beautiful thing is, these filaments are incredibly fragile. So again, gentle shaking. You can imagine wind blowing over a pond on the early Earth, making little waves. That would be enough to cause cell division. That's all you need. It's a very simple, very robust process. So together, those things give us a cycle of growth and division that can continue indefinitely. So this is a way that very simple chemistry and very simple physics can drive the growth and division of primitive cells with no evolved machinery. There's no internal machinery. It's just controlled by the environment. So that's all very nice, but these cells can't evolve. They can't become more complex. They can't adapt to new environments unless they have some genetic information, right? So that's why we have to come back to the RNA. And again, we have this puzzle of how these simple RNA molecules could replicate before there were any enzymes. There's no biological machinery. So we have to look to chemistry to solve that problem. And here is an animation made by Janet Iwasa when she was in my lab, illustrating the way we think about it. We have a little piece of RNA sort of waving in the breeze, nucleotides floating around, a very rich, chemically rich environment. They find their partner on the original strand by base pairing, A to U and G to C, and spontaneously build up a copy, a double helical structure. And so this process is something that people have been trying to make work in the lab for over 50 years. Okay. And the reason it's been so hard is because there are many, many things about this process that are not so easy. Right? When the first experiments were done by the late Leslie Orgel, who is a pioneer in this field, it looked like it might be easy. We were able to copy some short, simple sequences, but as other labs started to work on it, it became obvious that the process is too slow, it's not accurate enough. If it did work, you would have a double helix, but you couldn't get the strands apart so they could be copied again for the next generation. If you could get the strands apart, they would come back together. So the list of problems goes on and on. And so for many years, we thought, well, maybe it's impossible. Maybe there is no way that chemistry can actually do this, and we have to find another solution. There hasn't been any other solution. So we decided a few years ago to come back and look at all of these problems again, to see if we missed something the first time around. And in fact, we did. Many of them actually have simple solutions. I'm not going to bore you with all the details of the chemistry, but I can say we've solved most of these problems, not all of them. There are still a couple of difficult issues we're thinking about. We have ideas. We're working hard in the lab to make the process more efficient, faster, more accurate. I think we can do it, but it's not solved yet. If we can solve that problem, I think we'll be very close to being able to assemble primitive cells in the laboratory in a way that makes us think that life on the early Earth could arise easily. And then the last question is, well, where would this happen? We think environments that are volcanic or impact craters. Here we see Yellowstone Lake in the western United States. It looks very placid, but underneath there are hot water vents. The water gets heated by the hot rocks, comes up. And this is an environment where we think the right chemicals could be concentrated, and there are sources of energy, there's turbulence, there are fluctuating temperatures. We think this is the kind of environment that could nurture very primitive cells and allow life to begin. So with that, let me conclude and thank you all again for listening. Thank you.
Ahora nos deberían llegar algunas preguntas y mientras las esperamos, quizás yo pueda aprovechar de preguntarte un par de cosillas que yo creo que nos van a interesar. I'll say again. Te voy a preguntar algunas cosas que yo creo que nos pueden interesar. ¿Por qué ganaste el premio Nobel? ¿Qué fue lo que hizo que ganaras el premio Nobel?
So, when I first started my own laboratory, we worked on cellular processes that lead to... sorry, I can't talk and listen. We worked on DNA repair processes, and then I met Liz Blackburn, with whom I would end up collaborating, and she was working on something that looked like a piece of broken DNA, but it didn't act like it. It was very surprising to me, so we started to talk, we ended up collaborating. Eventually, we solved a particular puzzle about the replication of the ends of DNA molecules, telomeres. And that was very exciting at the time because, you know, we solved a long-standing puzzle. But then the real surprise was this: the solution to that puzzle turned out to be very important for our understanding of two things, cancer and aging. So in cancer, the cells need to keep dividing and dividing and dividing forever, and they turn on this enzyme that repairs telomeres. It's an essential part of that process. In aging, most of our cells don't have enough of this special enzyme, this telomerase, and so as we get older, our cells can only divide a certain number of times, and then eventually we can't repair our tissues. When we were doing the original work, we had no idea, that it would be important that it would explain such different things. So the reason we eventually won the Nobel Prize is because it turned out to be surprisingly important for things that matter to us.
I have a lot of questions that have to do with religion. So, what do you think about the role of God on all this?
Well, I believe Napoleon asked, who was the French scientist? It was earlier. There was a French scientist who had written a book of mathematical theories explaining nature. And Napoleon asked, well, why didn't you mention God in this book? And his answer was, I have no need of that hypothesis. To me, I think the origin of life is a perfectly natural phenomenon. We want to understand how this could happen in nature, and we don't think there's any need for any additional explanations.
In the same direction, we have a question here that's in the opposite of this. So life just was popping up by chance and by random situations, or we need something?
Well, I don't think of it as by chance or by randomness. I think of it as the laws of chemistry and physics are universal, and those laws of chemistry and physics determine the form of that a planet takes when it's developing. They determine the chemistry. And there are many different environments on a planet, right? Even within Chile, you have many different environments. I've seen some of them. They're very different. And so within that collection of different environments, the conditions will perhaps be just what you need for the origin of life. So it's not random in that sense. It's not like just a bunch of things crashing into each other and boom, all of a sudden you have life. It's a process that emerges naturally from the laws of nature.
Hay algunas preguntas que yo creo que Matthew podría responder mejor, así que las voy a dejar para después. Y la última pregunta, the last question, I guess, what should we look at if we are looking for new planets and we want to find life there?
Well, this is a subject of intense debate because, of course, it costs a lot of money to build these giant telescopes, many of which you have here in Chile, or to build space telescopes, right? So we need to know what to look for. The kind of obvious thing is, on our planet, life has, led to photosynthesis, which makes oxygen, and our atmosphere has oxygen. So we should look for oxygen. But that's not enough. There are purely physical, non-biological ways that a planet could end up with an atmosphere that contained oxygen. So we need to know more about the context. We need to maybe look for other collections of molecules. There's still a lot of debate. You know, if we get a signal that, yes, there's oxygen, there's ozone, maybe also methane, that would be a very strong hint of life, but might not be totally convincing. And we're all still thinking about how to make the strongest argument. What's the strongest signal to look for?
Of course.
Would polymers be a sign of life?
Yeah, but how can you look for polymers with a telescope? For that, we need to go to the stars, which we, of course, are now finally starting to think about, which is also really exciting.
So thank you, Jack. Thank you. Want to present Jack now, really. Jack, go.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you very much. Very, very interesting. I want to officially present Jack. I'm trying to behave now. He was born in London. He was raised in Canada. He's currently at the it's in Spanish, so voy a decirlo en español, perdón. Actualmente se desempeña como investigador en el Instituto Médico Howard Hughes, uno de los más prestigiosos en el campo de la biología molecular. Es profesor de genética en la Escuela de Medicina de la Universidad de Harvard y hace clases de química y biología en esa universidad. Es un investigador distinguido del Departamento de Biología Molecular del Hospital General de Massachusetts en Estados Unidos. Recibió su doctorado en la Universidad de Cornell y después de eso se trasladó a Harvard, donde aún trabaja. Muchas gracias, Jack, por tu tiempo, por tus ideas.
You can introduce me afterwards. Okay. Thank you all for showing up on this evening and for inviting the both of us. It's actually a little intimidating and quite an honor to follow Dr. Shostak for all the amazing work he's done. But I think it's an interesting pairing because while Dr. Shostak talked about how did life begin, what I've been focused on for the last 15 to 20 years in my research program is to figure out how we can precisely change the sequence of DNA, that code that Jack talked about, that codes for how what RNAs we make, which ultimately codes what the protein machines are, and then codes for how a cell functions. And what's very exciting in the last few years is we've developed the tools now to efficiently engineer life's code. And what I'm going to tell you about is some of our progress towards that, and then end with some discussion or some of my thoughts about how do you apply a new technology like this in the best way for humankind, and what sort of thoughts would one think about from an ethical standpoint to applying this? So I'm going to start with a quote, and I'm going to end with a quote. I don't know who K.R. Sridhar is, but I came across this quote in which he said, "A belief that finding innovative ways to make the world better is important. A mind in search of better ideas, even if they sound radical, is more likely to stumble across one." And I think this is probably a universal view of successful scientists, is that you have to search and push the boundaries, even if they sound crazy. And if they sound crazy, it might work. And so the crazy idea I had was we can change single nucleotides in the DNA at an efficient in an efficient way and use that method as a way of curing diseases. And why would I worry about this to cure diseases? Well, it turns out that there are perhaps 10,000 different diseases called genetic diseases or monogenic diseases in which a person is born with a variant in a gene, a sequence in their gene, that causes the protein that comes from that gene to behave abnormally, to give the person a disease. And it's estimated, now most of these diseases are quite rare, although the disease I'm going to focus on, sickle cell disease, is relatively common. But it's estimated that in sum, there's about 30 million people in the U.S. who have one genetic disease or another, and that there might be up to 350 million or more people worldwide that have these diseases. So again, these are diseases in which people are born with a variant in the letters of their DNA that leads to a protein to malfunction and causes a disease. And they span all of medicine, from hematology to your lungs, to your immune system, to your heart, to your skin, to your muscles, to your brain. So I'm going to use sickle cell disease or sickle cell anemia as an example. And this is a disease of red blood cells. So this is a normal-looking red blood cell. It has the ability to carry oxygen from our lung and deliver it to our distal tissues, where the oxygen gets utilized for the energy processes that our cells need. It has a property of being very squishy, and so it can squeeze through the tiny capillaries that deliver oxygen to our tissues. In sickle cell, and this is what a normal red blood cell looks like. In sickle cell disease, and this red blood cell is packed with a molecule called hemoglobin. And hemoglobin has four parts to it, what we call two alpha chains and two beta chains. And in patients with sickle cell disease, if you look at the letters of their beta chain, right here, instead of having an A, they have a T. And if you have two copies of the S gene, it leads you to having sickle cell anemia. And what happens is that the beta globin protein that's made from this beta globin gene, this beta globin S gene, when it loses oxygen, forms a long polymer, and converts this soft, malleable red blood cell into this red blood cell that adopts this sickle shape, giving the disease its name. And this stiff sickle cell is unable to traverse those small blood vessels, and what ends up happening is you get blockages of oxygen going to the tissues. And it's estimated that there are probably 300,000 to 500,000 people born every year with this disease. So if you think about it, in the 6 billion character genome, each we have two copies of our genome, so we're called diploid. There's 3 billion letters in each copy. And if you printed that out in a book with 9-point font and 500 characters per page, that would be a 1.1 million page book. And these people have a disease because there are just two typographical errors. That's it. And that leads to this devastating disease that I'm going to tell you about. So what happens is, again, we have the DNA code here, coding for the amino acid, the protein. And in the non-sickling beta globin gene, we have a glutamic acid, which is one of the 20 amino acids that form all proteins. And in sickle cell patients, we have a valine instead of a glutamic acid. And in honor of my chemistry colleague here, this has a charge to it, and this doesn't have a charge to it. And what happens is this uncharged residue allows polymerization of the beta globin, leading to this sickle cell shape. And so we go from DNA to protein to function. What happens then is these red blood cells adopt this sickle cell shape, form occlusions in the blood vessels. Oxygen doesn't get to the distal tissues. It damages the brain. It damages the lung. It damages the kidney. It damages all organs of the body. But the most frequent manifestation is shown in a picture here drawn by a patient with sickle cell disease depicting her painful bony crises. They develop these bony infarcts leading to severe pain. And obviously, I don't have the disease, but a sickle cell disease patient described it to me as if you've had your hand slammed in a car door, except instead of the pain lasting for a few minutes, it lasts for several weeks. And so she's sort of drawing what it feels like. Now, in the U.S., patients with sickle cell disease live on average about 40 years. But if you're in Africa and born with this disease, 50 to 80% of the patients die before the age of 5 years of age. So if you're in Africa, you die. In the U.S., you might live till you're 40, but you end up with these recurrent painful crises, and your quality of life is just simply terrible. And the problem here is out here in the red blood cell. So this is the blood tree, the tree of blood. And out here on the right are all the different types of blood cells we have. These all have limited lifespans. So, for example, a red blood cell only lives for about 120 days. So if we gave somebody some good red blood cells, that does them okay for about a month, and then we'd have to give them more red blood cells. And that's you can do that, but the problem is it leads to too much iron in the body. So to really fix this cell, we need to go back and fix this cell, which is the blood stem cell or the hematopoietic stem cell. And I want to be clear here that stem cell has sort of this weird terminology. And what we're talking here is a somatic stem cell. So it's capable of making all the blood cells, but it's not capable of making another human being, or it's not capable of making other tissues. And under a microscope, an electron microscope, it just looks like a bowling ball. And so in order to cure sickle cell disease, these red blood cells, what we need to do is figure out a way to fix the stem cell over here on the left. Okay, we need to change that T back to the A in the beta globin gene. Now one way of fixing this stem cell is to take the stem cells, the blood stem cells, from somebody who doesn't have the disease. And so we can do what's called a hematopoietic stem cell transplant or a bone marrow transplant, where we give the patient high doses of chemotherapy to eliminate their entire blood system, and then we take the stem cells from somebody who doesn't have the disease, but the gene is corrected, and we give them to the patient, and that cures the disease. It works. There's a problem, though, which is that only about 20% of patients actually have a donor that we can use, has to be an immunologic match. And even following the transplant, there's complications, including the fact that the donor immune system can attack the patient as being foreign, given a disease we call graft versus host disease. And this patient often has a poor immune system following a transplant, so they're susceptible to infections that they normally wouldn't be susceptible to. So what we've been thinking of is, can you just take the patient's own stem cells and correct them using genome editing? And the concept of genome editing is to basically edit the DNA to the sequence that you want. And if you think about this, this is the ultimate form of personalized medicine. We are going to specifically change the DNA sequence that causes the disease to a sequence that doesn't cause the disease. And how does genome editing work? Well, this is where science actually, you hear historical echoes. So Dr. Shostak talked about how early in his career, he's working on a process called DNA repair and recombination. Well, that's what I work on right now. And so what we do is we engineer a specific protein or an RNA protein complex that's designed to bind to a specific DNA sequence and break that DNA. Sort of seems counterintuitive. But by breaking the DNA, we activate the cell to fix that DNA. One of the ways the cell fixes the DNA is it just stitches the two ends back together, and it does that relatively accurately, although sometimes it can add bases or delete bases, and you can create a mutation there. And this is a good way of breaking genes. But, of course, we don't want to break this gene. We want to fix this gene. So in order to fix this gene, we have to tap into another way that cells repair double-stranded breaks, which is a process called homologous recombination. So we deliver, in addition to delivering our nuclease, that's the name of the protein that makes the break, we deliver a piece of DNA we call our donor DNA, which is essentially identical to the sequence around the break, except we also have incorporated the changes we want. And I'm from Silicon Valley in California, and so for me, it's on my Mac, it's Apple C, Apple V, which is make a copy of this and then paste it over the break to fix the break, and we can incorporate the sequence information into that, and we can now fix genes that way. So my lab worked for a number of years on all of these different types of ways of making a break. And then about 3 years ago, the CRISPR-Cas9 system was discovered. And just two slides on this system, because it has totally revolutionized the field. And for sure, this is going to get a Nobel Prize. It's a question of how and when and who, but it will get a Nobel Prize. And what's really interesting, and I didn't discover this system, so I can say that. It's a really fascinating story, because the discovery of this nuclease system that we're going to use to cure human patients of disease comes from bacteria, and it's a form of the bacterial immune system. So bacteria can get invaded by bacterial viruses, which we call phage, and these phage can kill the bacteria. So what the bacteria have developed is a system where when the phage come in, the CRISPR system will break the DNA of the phage into small parts and then incorporate it into an array and then make this complex with a Cas9 protein. Then they make a small RNA and they complex with a Cas9 protein. And the next time the phage comes in, this CRISPR-Cas9 nuclease is prepared to recognize the DNA of the phage and chop it all up before it has a chance to take over the bacteria. And amazingly, when you now just purify the Cas9 protein and complex it with a guide RNA, and the guide RNA is engineered to recognize the exact sequence you want in the human genome, this complex will find that sequence in the mammalian genome, that 6 billion base pair morass. It will find those two sites and make a break there. And so this, the ease of engineering, the specificity, and the activity of this system has really revolutionized the field of research and we think for therapeutics. So we're going to make a break using our CRISPR-Cas9, and we actually deliver this by complexing the protein with the guide RNA. And then we have to deliver We have to deliver the donor DNA, that template that's going to fix the gene, and we do that by hijacking a virus called AAV, which is a very efficient way of getting that DNA into the nucleus of these stem cells. So we basically put these cells into an electric field, the CRISPR-Cas9 gets into the nucleus, and then the virus delivers our DNA, and we get homologous recombination and fixing. So how well does this work? Well, it turns out that if we take stem cells from a sickle cell patient, and we run this process through where we give the virus that changes this T back to an A, and we measure how many genes get fixed, what we find is that on average, over 50% of the genes are fixed in these stem cells from sickle cell patients. And what we know is that if we could fix 10% of somebody's own cells, that would be enough to cure them of their disease. So we have a little buffer there. Now, one of the concerns is this whole process of putting the cells into an electric field and zapping them and exposing them to a virus, did we destroy their stem cell properties? And so while it's great that they're corrected, but they won't actually reconstitute the blood system the way we want. Now, the way to prove that is to do a clinical trial, but before they let us do a clinical trial, we have to sort of show that at least we think it'll work. And so what we did, is we took this population of cells in which there was about 50% correction, and we put the human cells into a mouse that was engineered to accept human cells without rejecting them, and we said, do these human stem cells make blood in this animal model, and does the cells that we corrected make blood? And what we see is that, yes, the stem cells engraft, and the level of correction is the same as what we found in the test tube. So these cells maintain their properties of having stem cells, and we have high frequencies of correction. So this tells us that we can do it all in the lab. So how are we going to do this in a patient? Well, ideally, what we'll do is we'll identify a patient before they have any symptoms of their disease. We will harvest their stem cells. And by the way, our stem cells are sitting in our bone, in our hips, but you can also get them from the blood. You can also get them from cord blood. And bring them to a laboratory where we'll purify the stem cells, and then we'll use our gene correction machinery to fix those cells. We can define how many cells we need, and we can define how many cells we need to correct, and then we can give them back to the patient. And the idea would be to do this before a patient even knew they have the disease. So this is exciting, and this is a platform technology that could be used for other purposes. And what has come up in our field, and let me make sure I'm not running too late, is how should we think about what if somebody were to use it for other ways, and how would we evaluate whether those are good ways or bad ways to use this, what I think is really exciting technology? And everyone is going to have ethical principles by which they make that judgment. But these are five ethical principles that I have used in thinking about how to apply this technology. The first comes from a philosopher, John Rawls, who proposed something called the veil of ignorance, which is that an ethical world is one, you would want a world in which you didn't know where into that world you were going to be born. So, you know, you could be born in Palo Alto, California, in a very great environment, or you could be born in a part of the world in which it wasn't so great. So the idea is we want to create a world where you didn't know where you're going to be born, and we should work towards that world. Believe that we should work toward minimize the suffering of individuals. I think we should work towards having a world where structural inequality is minimized. think it's important that we, even though this is an exciting technology, that we don't objectify individuals. That is, every individual is unique, and we don't treat humans as objects. And then finally, I think it's important to recognize that we should be humble and we should have a humility about how much we don't know and understand, and that we could do something now that might have consequences down the road. On the other hand, we shouldn't be bashful if we think we can minimize suffering and inequality. And how do you balance all of those things? So first of all, one of the things I'm worried about is this is the hospital I work at Stanford, and it's a beautiful hospital, and we have lots of resources, and we're going to be able to take this very complex process and do it here. But it turns out most of the patients with sickle cell anemia live in this part of the world, in this part of the world. And so we have to figure out a way of taking this very complicated process and bringing it to patients in parts of the world who aren't so fortunate to be in Palo Alto, California. So that's the idea of minimizing inequality. And one of the ways to do that would be to take this very fancy facility we have and turn it into a box, and take a $10 million facility and turn it into a $100,000 box that could be used over and over again, and you could make this manufacturing quite simple. All the reagents I described to you are chemicals, and if you can make chemicals cheaply once you know what you need to make. So that's one thought. The other big ethical issue that people have talked about is, for what purposes should we use this in humans? And this is an old 2x2 box that came out of the 1970s before genome editing was around, but people, ethicists were thinking about, should you manipulate the DNA to cure and prevent disease? Should you manipulate, and should you do that in somatic cells? So somatic cells would be cells that stay with the person but don't get passed on to future generations. What if you became so good at it that we could enhance somebody's traits? So you weren't helping a disease, but you were making them stronger or taller or whatever trait you want to think of. But again, it would end with that patient. And then over here is the idea, well, what if we could do this in a way that would be inherited in future generations? Should we modify somebody's DNA so that they won't pass along sickle cell disease to their kids, or they won't pass along Huntington's disease to their children? And so we could potentially eliminate diseases from the human race. And then finally, should we create races of human being that are enhanced? And I have shaded these things. Sorry, the computer has changed my colors. So obviously, I believe that somatic cell editing for disease prevention is something we should be doing. I think this should be light red or pink, because I think the idea of using somatic cell editing for enhancement violates some of those properties about treating humans as objects, because now we'll be engineering people for certain purposes rather than just having to be humans. You also could be potentially creating more inequality in the world. I think the idea of heritable editing is in a light green, and that's just my own personal view, but others feel like this would be something you wouldn't even do to prevent disease. And I think the concept of trying to do heritable editing for enhancement is a bright red for me. Now, one thing I would point out is that if we got really good at this, we probably wouldn't need to do that. And so that's one of the things that we're thinking about in the future. So I told you I had to end with a quote, and this is the quote, which is, I want to stay as close to the edge as I can without going over. Out on the edge, you can see all kinds of things you can't see from the center. And again, I think this is something that those of us who are excited about science try to live by. We don't want to just look at what everyone else knows. We want to look and peer into the abyss where we don't know what's going on. And I'm going to end with a picture of my dog, and I was glad to see at the Congress that there's a dog next to Santiago, so this is a big part, and I love all the dogs around here. So thank you very much, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Well, thank you very much. Again, very interesting and very all. Both things are those things that scare us. Mientras esperamos las preguntas, tengo una pregunta así como de la profundidad de esto. Matt, after you get a human genetically modified, Is that person the same person?
So that's a really interesting question about what is identity. How do we define identity? And I am not one who believes that you define identity by the sequence of your DNA. I think that is part of your identity, but I think your identity reflects a very interesting and complex mix of not only my mic went, oh, there you go. Not only your DNA sequence, but also the environment you grew up on, the things you've been taught, the things you've learned, and the different exposures you've had. The other reason I think it's really important not to think about your DNA as defining identity is while at birth we are all born with a unique genome, that no one is ever born with the same sequence of DNA as someone else. Now you say, "What, Matt, what about identical twins?" Sure, the very first cell is identical. But after one round of division, there's an error rate, and all of a sudden the genomes are diverging. And so right now I have, I think the number is like 10 trillion cells in me. Every cell in my body has a DNA sequence that's different than every other cell in the body. So to think that DNA defines identity, I think is not correct.
That's
hopefully
nice.
Jack doesn't disagree.
That's
nice.
Totally agree. Yeah.
I have a couple of questions in the same direction. And it's, do you think with this technology we can live forever?
Maybe I can just go with no. and part of the reason I say that is, first of all, I don't know of anything that's immortal. I'm a believer that if there's an example in nature, then we can probably mimic it. But evolution has gone on for 3.8 billion years, and there's no such thing as something that's immortal. So I don't think we can get there. The other thing I think is that there's a balance, and Jack actually talked about this about his Nobel Prize, is cancer, to prevent cancer is actually the antithesis of aging. You know, cancer cells can live for a long time. And I think that if you created cells that protected their telomeres and were long so that the cells didn't get old, what you would predispose those cells to doing is getting cancer, and so you'd end up dying of cancer. So I think that we live in this balance between things.
Where do you want to be in 20 years from now with your research?
Yeah. Where I want to be is, so what I described to you in terms of correcting the mutation for sickle cell anemia, we've done all in the laboratory. In the U.S. now, we need to scale that process up so we can do not just a couple million cells, but a couple hundred million cells. We need to prove that the cupcake we can now make 200 cupcakes using the same recipe. And we need to go through a regulatory process that takes some time, but we're hoping to treat our first patient in 2018. Now, what I really hope in 20 years is that by 2018 that we have shown that it works and that we do get to Africa and we get to babies and we have a system in place where everyone who might have this disease has the access to this type of therapy to cure them of their disease.
I want to ask you both a couple of things very shortly. Could you explain to us how is your everyday life? Like you wake up and do what? Because you seem like special.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that I enjoy is my life is very varied. Some days I go into the lab and talk to my students about experiments or work on writing papers. Some days I visit the other campuses.
How many
of
students
Harvard.
You have?
Well, my lab is about 20 people altogether. Okay. So, you know, a lot of smart people. They're fun to talk to. I enjoy that. Sometimes I'm doing other things at my hospital or my university, so other committees, different problems to solve. Sometimes I'm traveling to great places like this and having a good time. So, yeah, so it's not one thing. It's the variety that keeps everything interesting.
What about you, Mark?
Yeah, more or less the same. My lab size is around 12, so a little smaller, but with, again, fantastic people who are let's see, busy working hard right now while I get to spend time with you all. I'm also an MD, so I spend part of my time working in a medical doctor. Mm-hmm. So and I'm a pediatrician, and so I actually take care of children who are undergoing those bone marrow transplants I talked about. So I spend about 4 weeks a year doing that. Luckily, I have expert clinicians who support me, who do it full time, and I really enjoy that patient interaction. Partly because it helps drive what we're trying to do in the lab. But as Jack said, some of the most enjoyable parts is it's fun talking to students, the trainees in my lab about what they're doing. But some of the most exciting things is to when somebody in the lab comes and says, I got a new piece of data to show you. And you look at it and you go, you know, everything looks beautiful. You know, the controls are done and you know that the data is right and you know you're moving on to the next step. Those aren't daily occurrences in the research. I think it takes a personality to tolerate valleys because there's periods where nothing works. But there's these real peaks. And you have to have a personality where you derive long-term satisfaction from those peaks to allow you to get through those periods, that those deserts. Yeah.
Last question.
Yeah.
What do you think for both about investigating something that doesn't have any application right now, like the one you're doing now or the one that gave you your Nobel Prize or CRISPR-Cas9 that didn't make any sense at the beginning? What do you think about that?
I can start with that. I think it's a no-brainer. I think you absolutely have to study things that you don't think have any applications, that by studying things for pure knowledge is incredibly important, because, A, that just makes us smarter about the world and understand the world better, but, B, the CRISPR-Cas9 is a wonderful system. People were studying how bacteria resist phage, not ever expecting that that was going to lead to people like myself being able to use that tool to apply it, because you never know where things are going to come from. And in fact, sorry, I'll get on a little bit on a soapbox. Again, I wear a medical doctor hat and I wear a PhD, a scientist hat. And one of the reasons I don't do medicine full time is that if you don't do research, you end up doing the same thing every day. You're stuck where you are today. And if you want to get better in therapy, you have to do research. And for me to do my research, there's got to be basic scientists who are doing basic research. And I think that it's this tree or this I don't even, pyramid, whatever. It's a whole, you know, chain of things that allows us to go from basic to improving the lives of people.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I totally agree. I mean, I think answering very fundamental questions is a part of our culture. It's something that can be justified just as a way of having a better understanding of the world that we live in. But then, of course, it's also totally true that all of the advances that lead to practical applications emerge in surprising ways from trying to answer more fundamental questions.
And I have a curiosity. Is this something that special people get?
this pin was given to me at the Nobel Prize ceremony.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Very nice.
Bueno, nos queda tiempo para una pregunta. Si hay alguien que quiera hacer una pregunta. No? Sí. Yeah. Ahí hay uno. Sí, dale.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Membrane and all these changes.
Right.
How would you expect that to just come up by chance?
Well, it couldn't. No cell as complicated as a modern cell could arise by chance. Right? You have to have initially very simple cells that arise, because there are physical processes that make membranes form spontaneously. There are chemical processes that make things like RNA form spontaneously. And then, over millions and billions of years of Darwinian evolution, cells live and die, propagate in different environments. They adapt. They struggle to become, to compete with other organisms. And that leads to this growth in complexity that we see in modern biology. So it's a process. It's the result of a long process of Darwinian evolution.
Okay, thank you. Okay. I want thank to present Matthew, because I didn't present him.
I
had to follow the order. No? Matthew Porteous es doctor, es médico norteamericano, estudió medicina en la Universidad de Harvard, obtuvo su magíster y doctorado en la Universidad de Stanford en Estados Unidos, inició su carrera en el Hospital de Niños de Boston y en el Instituto del Cáncer de Dana-Farber, se especializó en hematología y oncología. Realizó su postdoctorado en el MIT y en el Instituto de Tecnología de California, en donde inició su trabajo en la edición del genoma humano, siendo la primera persona en demostrar que nucleasas modificadas podían usarse para modificar células humanas. Actualmente es miembro del Consejo Científico Asesor de CRISP Therapeutics, que es una empresa. Además, se desempeña como docente de pediatría en la División de Hematología, Oncología y Terapia Genética Humana en la Escuela de Medicina de la Universidad de Stanford. Además, atiende como doctor en el Hospital Infantil de Lucile Packard en la Unidad de Transplante de Médula Pediátrica.